Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset.
I see a candlelight down in the little green valley, where the morning glory vines are twining round the door.
When we hear country twang like this, our mind typically imagines walking through the saloon doors of a Nashville bar, seeing folks wearing cowboy boots and Stetson hats. But while Nashville may be Music City, this particular band is actually from Chicago. They're called the Sundowners, and were just one in a long history of fantastic country acts in the Windy City. Chicago's been part of country music's history from the very beginning, whether it was Grand Ole Opry-style variety shows, rowdy country western bars, or the emergence of alt country. Chicago has had a hand in evolving the genre sound. Now, the history of that influence is documented in a new book called Country and Midwestern, Chicago and the History of Country Music and the Folk Revival. To learn all about it, we're talking to the author, Mark Guarino. We're also joined by Robbie Fulks. He's a prolific musician who's been a part of Chicago's country and folk scene for decades and even wrote the foreword for Mark's book. Also with us is Jane Baxter Miller. She's another fixture in the Chicago country scene and has released solo albums, along with being part of the duo Texas Rubies. Mark, tell us a bit about the inspiration behind the book. Why'd you want to share this history?
Sure. Well, you know, the simple reason is that it just wasn't out there, and most people didn't know any, including me. And my idea for the book goes back a couple decades, actually, when I was covering music full time in the 90s, and I was watching this great scene really emerge from the previous decade. A lot of DIY musicians were starting record labels, moving to Chicago to play music, mm-hmm. and there was this great alt country scene that was happening, including Robbie and Jane here, and I was thinking, well, why was this happening here? And I kind of looked back and saw the threads go back very far, even though you may not have realized it. And mm-hmm. the book covers almost 100 years. And I found that even though they were all kind of disparate time periods, that they were really, that there was this kind of beautiful connection among all these time periods, too, yeah. up to the present day.
Jane, you and I were just dancing to the opening track there. As a musician, how well do you think it's known that Chicago does have a country music scene?
I have no idea. I don't think it's very well known.
Yeah.
I think we have a really lovely community here amongst country music, and I'm glad that Mark wrote the book
yeah.
so that more people can know.
Why do you think that's the case, Robbie? That not enough people knew about it?
Well, I think that the commercial center of country music is obviously 450 miles south of here, and that's where the publishing and the labels and all of the the corporate super and infrastructure mm-hmm. are. And so we've got a ton of great musicians here in all styles of music, but as far as country, I mean, it has such a geographic center to it, the business does. That's a bit of a handicap, I think, for Chicago.
Yeah. All right. So let's dive into the book. I want to start with where country music really begins in Chicago. A lot of that has to do with radio and radio programs like National Barn Dance. So here's a little bit of what that program sounded like.
Thanks, Eddie Peabody. That old cider song was never snappier, which reminds me, we're due for another good old harvest home ditty. And from the bell of the barn dance and her bestest beau, Lulu Bell and Scotty.
When the moon goes to-shining and the heart goes to-pining from a Blue Ridge Mountain home, where the hound dogs are baying and the pine trees...
So tell us about the National Barn Dance and how it came about.
It was this improbable story that in the South Loop in 1924 when WOLS went on the air, and radio was a new technology. A lot of people didn't have radios and were fast, buying them or building them themselves. And it was an experiment, like today with streaming. They were trying to figure out content to put on the air. And someone one Saturday night decided to get some country fiddlers to come and play on a Saturday night, and it was such a huge hit, they built a show around that. There was nothing really like it beforehand. It was really the first time that they created a blueprint for how to sell this music to the masses and the kind of live entertainment, but on the radio. And over many years, a lot of musicians from the South, Kentucky, the Appalachian area, came here. They adopted new personas. They adopted even new storylines, biographies, and they became massive stars. They recorded here for big labels. There were a couple Hollywood movies, but also there were a lot of road shows. They toured all around the country. And so it was this infrastructure that kind of came out of nowhere here to sell music to people who lived in rural America, not necessarily Southern America, but it was the country was more rural then. And that's kind of the idea of the book, that country music's origins were really much more about rural people and what they liked and what they were interested in than just a Southern thing.
Yeah. Robbie and Jane, I'm curious to hear your reactions to that music. I mean, what part of it feels maybe familiar or foreign to you?
The harmony feels just totally relevant and right now, but maybe that's just because I'm an old guy. What do you think?
I love the harmony. I love it all. It actually makes me think of Heather McAdams and Chris Legan's Country Calendar Show, which they do every year. And
Fitzgerald's, yeah.
Yeah, Fitzgerald's, and brings some of that kind of old-timey feel back to it, you know? But yeah, it feels like – it all feels like home to me because I am from Appalachia originally, so –
If you're just joining us, we're discussing a new book that chronicles how Chicago has shaped country and folk music through the decades. With us is the author Mark Guarino, as well as musicians Robbie Faulks and Jane Baxter Miller. So help us understand, Mark, what made National Barn Dance and WLS so much more successful than other programs and radio stations?
It was really its marketing genius and also the talent it had here. There was a man named John Lair who's from Appalachia who came here, had no experience at all, but he loved showbiz. He really wanted to get into showbiz. So he became really active in going down to the South and scouting talent to come up. And once they did, he signed them to contracts. He gave them storylines and backstories and sometimes new names. But what he did really was kind of create this cast of characters that had a real broad appeal. And people really loved them and they loved the songs. And then what he did after that was that he basically put them in front of people in any way he could, not just the broadcast, but again, kind of road shows through small towns all throughout the Midwest and the South, and built up this sort of stable of stars there was nothing really like it at the time. And so after a while, they got a national sponsor and it became a coast to coast program from the South Loop. That's which is what you wouldn't imagine what we just heard coming out of the South Loop, but it did.
Sure did. And throughout the book, you profile various artists from that time period. One of them is Bradley Kincaid. You call him the first country music star, right? So let's first listen to his song, Barbara Allen.
In Scarlet Town, where I was born, there was a fair maid dwelling, made every youth cry well away. Her name was Barbary Allen. It was all in the month of June.
So who's Bradley Kincaid?
Bradley Kincaid was someone from Appalachia who came up to study. He came up here to go to college. But he got... along with John Lair. John Lair got him on the program because I think he initially went there to audition to just make some side money while he was up here. And he was really significant because at the time, a lot of people didn't have records or record players, and so he went down to the South and found a lot of those songs that were passed by an oral tradition. And he produced songbooks, and he was the first one to create this sort of strange to us now today of a phenomenon of creating songbooks where you can now like learn the songs in the home. So he was replicating them. And there was a publishing company in Chicago that produced them, and these sold by the millions. I mean, it created this sort of new venue again for the music of the Bradley Kincaid songbooks. And so he was a performer who helped kind of spread, who take this music from a very kind of isolated pocket of the country and really spread it through not just his recordings and what he did on the radio, but through all this publishing he did as well.
Robbie, was that an inspiration for you?
Yeah, I still love the music, and the stories in the music are, you know, like that song goes back at least 200 years before that recording. And so there's sort of a DNA there that I think I relate to. And a lot of people from, you know, say the UK and Ireland where those songs come from relate to them.
Yeah. I saw you close your eyes there, Jane. It felt like you were almost transporting yourself back to that time.
Oh, totally. Totally. Just to listen to that. That sound and that those words, it's a beautiful, beautiful song. And yeah,
so pure, back. Right?
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, another artist profiled in this chapter, Patsy Montana. Let's hear her playing the song Mexicali Rose. So something interesting in the book, Mark, is when you talk about how women weren't typically the stars of the show when it comes to barn dance, mm-hmm. right? But somehow Patsy broke that mold.
Right. And I think one of the reasons was she had a real just big, bold personality, too. And I think that really stood out. And she became a star that brought a lot of other women to Chicago and encouraged and after Patsy Montana, there were a lot of actually female groups. And it was really because of her. And she was the first female country music star in terms of record sales as well. And one of her songs, I Want to Be a Cowboy Sweetheart, has been covered by
song.
Everybody. And oddly enough, I interviewed Cyndi Lauper for this book.
Did
because
you really?
At the time of writing it, she had recorded a country record, and she recorded that song, and she knew
Cyndi
all
Lauper
about it.
Has
yes.
a country record?
She, oddly enough, she has a country record. It's out there, people.
I got to hear it. Everyone's going to YouTube right now.
That's right. That's right.
Are you a Patsy Montana fan, Jane?
Oh, big fan. Absolutely. And like what Mark said, she really paved the way for a lot of female singers and songwriters and musicians.
Great yodeler.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I'd launch into yodel right now, but it's a little too early.
Can you? Please. I think you'd love that. I want to fast forward a little bit in time and pivot more to the folk side of things. So you dedicate this whole chapter to the founding of the Old Town School of Folk Music. So why do you see the school having such a big influence on country and folk music history?
Sure. Without the Old Town School, this book wouldn't exist. And the reason is because there was really no other organization like it since and like it before and like it since. And the reason it became kind of the center in Chicago where people who were kind of like middle-class suburbanites, for instance, had never heard of this music before, could go there and be exposed to all of it, but do it in a way where it wasn't kind of like a conservatory method of learning music where it's one-on-one. It was in a group setting, and it was really about the songs. It wasn't necessarily having technical proficiency or anything like that. It gave a platform for a lot of the folk revival stars home when they were coming through Chicago to perform. And the Old Town School kind of shows up in every chapter of this book because it went out when Uptown was filled with tens and thousands of Southerners coming up. The Old Town School went there and gave out guitars and really made them feel at home and hold community sings. And also it was a place where they hired musicians as well to teach and perform. I know Robbie was a teacher there as well. It's really a completely unique organization.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in many ways, the approach to folk and country music was different from that of barn dance. I mean, what made Old Town's approach distinct?
Well, it was rooted in it came out of the folk revival of the late 50s. And it really came with this group of people who were discovering all these recordings from the barn dance days and those musicians from that era, the 20s and 30s. And so people had forgotten about that music by the time of the 50s. And so there was sort of a reawakening, sort of a backlash against rock and roll. And so all these people discovered, hey, you know, there's this music that, as Robbie said, goes back hundreds of years that we knew nothing about, and we like it, and we want to perform it. Mm. And that was, if you think about it, at the time, it was something completely new, and the Old Town really kind of drove it home in Chicago and spread its popularity.
Here's a recording we have of Frank Hamilton, one of the central figures you talk about in this section.
takes a worried man to sing a worried song. Takes a worried man, sing a worried song. Takes a worried man to sing a worried song. I'm a worried now, but I won't.
So Mark talks in the book about how Frank's style of teaching was like non-traditional. I'm curious what your thoughts are on this philosophy. It was basically centered on teaching songs as opposed to scales and notes and theory.
Yeah, I guess when I taught there, I mean, one thing is I don't know a lot about scales and notes and theory, so it wouldn't
so
be,
you would have liked that philosophy.
Well, it wouldn't be smart of me to try to do that. I did try to do a little bit of that because it's like a little bit of that is helpful. But I think more what I tried to do, yeah, was send out song sheets and they had chords on top of them. This is when I taught at Old Town. Mm-hmm. And also just try to like, I mean, inspire is a big word, but just try to like model what I thought was musical behavior, which was like getting emotionally into songs, singing loud, looking at people in the face, encouraging them to get into the like the collective mindset of we're doing something together.
Yeah.
We're creating an emotional event together. And I think that's way more important than theory and scales.
Probably more effective too. What do you think, Jane?
Well, I'm with Robbie. I am, you know, my guitar skills, I know, that's why one reason I play country music, because I know three chords. I mean, that's about it.
So the non-traditional would have worked for you, too.
Oh, absolutely. Put me in, yeah.
To what degree, Mark, was the folk revival and the Old Town School part of a larger political movement in Chicago?
Well, it came out of the labor movement, really. A lot of the founders were people who were just helped found the labor movement, especially in Chicago, with people like Stud Sterkel and Win Strachey. These were people who knew Woody Guthrie and would perform, you know, folk music at union halls and that kind of thing. You know, there really was a belief that you really have to think about at the time that we're, you know, rock and roll had basically spread out everywhere in suburbia and it was kind of a scary thing. And there was kind of a thing of like, hey, there's this music that's inherently American and it kind of goes back really, really far. And we kind of forgot all about it. And I think there was what I find kind of beautiful about it was the enthusiasm mm-hmm. there was for discovering not just folk music, but dance and music from other different parts of the world. I think people were just kind of like kind of opening their eyes and seeing what was beyond kind of this like suburban 50s Mad Men sort of thing we've seen. They were also kind of radicals, too. One thing about the book is that they were all under surveillance by the FBI at the same time. And that's one thing I discovered. Even the families of these people I talked with didn't know
that.
Yeah,
I found that part surprising.
Yeah, and the FBI really destroyed, for instance, Win Strachey's life at the end because they harassed him and they made him lose work. And so the Old Town School was really his last hurrah, and I think he did a pretty good job with it.
Well, before we take a quick break, I'm going to play some more music. This is by one of the mainstay artists in the folk scene, Stu Ramsey. Before we take that pause, Mark, any brief words about Stu?
Stu was a really, really young guy who was this guitar prodigy living in Elmhurst. And the Old Town School embraced him, and he started teaching there. And he was kind of a blues white blues prodigy at the time, and then got a record of course, and that was it.
Several venues were part of the scene here. One that played a big role in country and folk music here was Club Lower Links, where I believe you played with your band Texas Rubies, right?
That's right.
Give us a sense of where this venue was, first of all, and what it looked like.
Oh, well, I don't know the exact address. Do you all know Newport?
It was right near Wrigley Field, a couple blocks
away.
So Lakeview.
Lakeview, absolutely.
And this was a club that was underneath Lower Links. You know, Lower Links is still an arts organization, a performance venue, and they've moved. But this was underneath, so it was Club Lower Links, and you had to go down.
Down into the basement,
and it was like this dark cabaret vibe. I remember, I was soon after I'd first moved here, I went down there. I was like, "What? I am in the big city now. This is very mysterious."
I mean, what was it about this venue? Why was it so important to you and to other artists, you think?
Well, Lee Jones, it was her club, and she is a force of nature, and she just brought in an eclectic mix of performance artists and jazz musicians and country musicians. Kelly and I opened for the Sundowners Club Lower Links. And I think it's all because of Lee. She just curated this space and created a vibe there that was so special. And when I read in your book, Mark, that it was like 3 years or something, I was like, time is so weird. Because it feels like it felt like it was a lifetime. You know, when I think back on it, it was just like, it was so influential in my life. And I usually do theater, and Kelly and I were trying to get a gig at Lower Links, and I called Lee and was like, hey, you know. And so she called back with all these dates that she was just offering us one, but I thought she was offering us all of them because I didn't know any better. So I was like, sure, we'll do all of them. And she just started laughing and said, okay. And that's really, she really helped us out a lot, gave us a place to play. So,
well, let's listen to some of your music, Jane. This one's called Someone You Used to Love. This is by your band, Texas Rubies.
First of all, I got to say, that's Kelly Kessler wrote that song. Mm. And so, shout out to Kelly.
Is she singing it or are you singing
it? I'm singing it.
Okay,
that's Jane's voice
right there.
That's me. Yeah.
Just had to clear that up.
Thank you. Thanks, Robbie. I guess I got my start. I grew up in Kentucky in Appalachia, but I didn't start. I thought it was hillbilly music, and I didn't want anything to do with it. But when I went to school in West Virginia University, and I started listening to bluegrass music and started hanging around all the bluegrass musicians and started singing. And that's when I really fell in love with it. And I had no idea when I moved to Chicago that I was going to meet Kelly Kessler, who had just graduated from Berea College down in Kentucky and had fallen in love with country music down there. So, but that's how, yeah.
Yeah. That's a great story. You know, there's a sizable chapter in the back half of your book, Mark, talking about the emergence of alternative country, or alt country, as it's typically called. Define alt country for us. What is it, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, I think today we would call it Americana music. And that's the kind of cool thing about that alt country music, is that at the time there was kind of an alternative to. It was a time when a lot of, you know, country music had gone into stadiums with people like Garth Brooks and Shania Twain. And so there was a real interest in musicians kind of looking back at sort of older forms of country music, but also kind of like infusing it with a modern sensibility. So musicians who weren't just doing sort of museum pieces, but were kind of doing modern music, but steeped in with both the instruments and the themes of what we would consider classic country music.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to an example from you, Robbie. This is She Took a Lot of Pills and Died.
Uh-oh.
It's from your album Country Love Songs.
As could be, and a world-famed Hollywood star. With the big parts coming and the sweethearts too, life was a hell of a ride.
This is Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We are discussing Chicago's influence on country and folk music, which is all documented in the new book Country and Midwestern. With us is Mark Guarino and musicians Robbie Falks and Jane Baxter Miller. And we are currently listening to a song off Robbie's first album, Country Love Songs.
While the traffic crawled by in the street outside, she was sitting in her kitchenette, listening to the scuttle of the rats.
So I got to ask you, Robbie, what does alt country mean to you?
Well, Sasha, I thought I was doing country music. I honestly didn't know.
And then they gave you this label, and you said, what?
Got the label, and to me, I mean, I don't want to sound too cynical, but to me the label means it's not... people don't buy it a lot, and you know, it's like not right in the commercial center things. And the players on it, like, aren't those, you know, they're Chicago people who are good musicians and everything. But I mean, you can hear from that. We were just kind of in somebody's basement figuring out, trying to figure out what to do.
Sounds like fun.
It was fun.
Yeah. You're a songwriter, and you were a songwriter in Nashville for a period of time. You also recorded and you released a record on Bloodshot. What have you observed being part of both the commercial and DIY country scenes? And by Bloodshot, I mean Bloodshot Records, which was another main character in this book.
Yeah. Well, I observed, like, no Venn diagram overlap, basically, like zero. And, like, my, I don't know if you call them bosses or whatever, but my publisher and the people at Bloodshot, they're running that label, each of them didn't really want me doing the other thing. I mean, they told me as much. They were like, just focus on this one thing that we're trying to do here.
You're either making music in Nashville or you're making music
right
here in Chicago.
It's almost like, do you want to be an oceanographer or an architect? Like, the two, like, don't really have much to do with one another, you know? And so my attitude back then was that I just want to be a part of the music business somehow. I want to get out of this, like, day labor that I'm stuck in, and I want to go make music for people. And so if the Nashville thing works for me, that's great. And if the other thing works for me, like, I'll either be a songwriter, a professional songwriter, or this DIY punk country guy. So the latter worked out. That's what I did.
And Mark, fill us in on the background here on Bloodshot Records.
Sure. So it was a label that kind of came out of the DIY punk scene. They were three people who had relatively no music industry experience and got to it because they wanted to document sort of the scene I was describing that I was seeing.
Yeah.
It took off really, really fast. I think that, the early days really did. It was very influential because a lot of major labels started kind of subsidiary labels that were better funded and actually stole some of their artists and also stole a lot of what the idea they were doing to push a lot of that music into the mainstream. So the audience was there. I think that the greater music industry didn't really recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what it was. You know, I always like to talk about in 1996, I'd never heard of Robbie, and he had a record out, but I went to go see a show at Fitzgerald's, and Robbie was opening up, and he came out, and I had never seen anything like his band. Mm-hmm. It was just wild and fast, and the musicians were incredible, and his energy was really out of this world. And then the headliner went on who had all this press, and it was kind of more traditional. I thought, I want more of that guy because I felt he was way more modern.
More of the wild guy.
I felt like he was much more modern. That he was a modern artist who wasn't really approaching the music as this old thing. It was a new thing, but it was what he thought country music was.
Mm-hmm. Jane and Robbie, I know that you both have some events coming up related to this book, so let's hear about them. Jane, you first.
Well, June 10th, we're going to be doing a Texas Rubies reunion.
Okay.
At the Hideout, and Mark's going to talk about the book, and yeah, so looking forward to that.
June 10th.
And Mark and I are doing something over at Park West tonight.
Yeah. Yeah, tonight at the Park West, we'll be talking about the book, and then Robbie will be doing a full set of music from his new record, and he'll have a band there as well.
Love that. You know, the country scene, it continues to thrive and evolve here in Chicago. There's a host of musicians participating in things like Cosmic Country Showcase and creating their own country music, if you will. Why do you think that this genre continues such fertile ground in Chicago?
Well, you know, I think that it's always been a place for musicians to come, and there's so much. What's great about what's happening now is that, I feel like there's been more places to play that mm-hmm. really, and so musicians are kind of still doing their own thing without caring about what's going on in the big industry towns, and because there's an opportunity to perform here and get an audience here.
Yeah,
the other thing I think we forget about is that there's actually an audience here that goes out to hear, listen to music. And it's a normal thing to go do, like going to see a movie.
Absolutely.
I guess streaming has maybe hurt that a little bit, but I think that's, what's been great is that there's just more, there's shows and pottery studios and wine shops and distilleries
and basements in
Lakeview alongside all the regular clubs and bars and stuff. So it's still pretty fertile.
Why do you think it's been able to stay alive, Jane?
Well, I think Chicago is just a really special place, and I think country music in particular just resonates with so many people's soul. It just resonates, I think.
Yeah. We got just a little more time here, and I want to talk about one more band called Special Consensus. Mark, tell us a bit about them.
Well, Special Consensus has been around since about 1975, and in a way they're the Menudo of bluegrass music.
Yeah, that's exactly what they are.
And there's a fellow named Greg Cahill who is a terrific banjo player, and he's from a south suburb, and he fell in love with the music, and he formed Special Consensus, and they were really the first bluegrass band outside the South to get recognized as just a true bluegrass band.
Yeah.
And in the early days, they would play all the festival circuit, and people would leave once they heard they were playing. They were from Chicago because they wouldn't hear of it.
Oh, no.
But so he opened doors. He opened a lot of doors. You know, there's a bluegrass band in every corner now. You know, every coffee shop is a bluegrass band.
Yeah.
At the time, not at all. And Special Consensus really was kind of opened the door. And Robbie was a member.
Robbie was part of the group at one time. I mean, what did you learn from playing with this band?
Well, I'll tell you, I learned work ethos because Greg was just like working around the clock on this thing. You know, he booked the band. We worked 200 dates a year, and we all helped drive the van around to these places and do music. And so for me in my 20s, like Mark said, I was kind of on the wild side, and I like to drink whiskey and hoot and holler and jump around.
Look at that.
But to do it all this as a job and to do it that many days and that steadily, I had to learn to calm down a little bit and mm-hmm. to get into the rhythm of road life and just to sort of survive out of my 20s to learn stuff like that from the older guys like Greg.
Well, let's go out on a song that feels like a fitting bookend to our conversation. It's called Chicago Barn Dance from local group Special Consensus. This episode of Reset was produced by Andrew Merriweather, and it was edited by Ethan Schwab and Dan Tucker. If you love hearing great interviews about Chicago's culture and history, have you made sure to hit that subscribe button? We share episodes like this throughout the week, along with all the big stories shaping our region. That'll do it for Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Western wear, Lulabelle and Scotty are quite a pair. Monroe Brothers, former Square, and Spin the Pretty Girls. Red Foley and Brad Kincaid, a banjo picking Lily May. Patsy Montana steals the stage, yodeling for the world.
They say the line winds and snakes down Wabash and back up base. Have to get your tickets in advance. Chicago Barn Dance.
taking this show on the road. Evening papers told us so. All proceeds to the USO bring rubber and scrap iron.
Friends and neighbors gather round. Let's get this old truck loaded down. We'll do our bit to help the best we can.
Finally, our way is clear to see the music that we hear. Today's the day we're gonna get our chance. Well, the place is packed and every seat. Happy faces, patting feet. The band drives a hillbilly beat. There's magic in their hands.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.